Welcome to the Fantasy Baseball Today podcast from CBS Sports.
High drive, center field, hit the wall, grand slam. This is magnificent.
Got a fantasy question? Email fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. Get ready to win your league.
Where fantasy becomes reality.
Now, here's Frank, Scott, Chris, and Adam.
Just 2 years ago, Javier Baez was a top 10 player in Roto and a top 15 hitter in points leagues. Why no love? We'll try and get to the bottom of this today. Happy Monday, Fantasy Baseball Today. I am Frank, joined by Adam, Scott, and Chris. Chris, I know that you enjoyed a snowstorm, much like I did, in New York this past weekend.
Yeah. I went out for a bike ride on Saturday. That's something I'm trying to do a little more often, and it started snowing on May 9th, which, I mean, living in South Florida my whole life, any snow would be shocking, but snow in the middle of May, I didn't know that was a thing that happened. So that was delightful, actually. It was a really joyful thing to have happened. So I'm glad I got to experience that.
It doesn't normally happen. I've lived in New York my entire life. Adam's been here the past couple of years. Adam, I'm going to assume that you weren't out playing in the snow this weekend.
I've been here for like 6 years now. Okay. But much like Chris, he said he wanted to get out and bike more. I opened my blinds on Saturday or Sunday, whenever that was. That is something that I'd like to start doing more. And I did notice it was snowing. And I was like, Allie, come here. Bring the baby. Check this out. And she didn't care at all. So that was disappointing because it was really fun to see this snow, but probably not fun to be in. I was glad I was inside.
Was it the kind that like dissolved on impact?
Or? Yeah, it was like the lightest flurry possible.
Yeah.
It barely counts as snow.
It was really windy where I was. So it looked like the apocalypse, basically.
The weirdest thing is it was just so sunny. It was like the sunniest day ever. And out of nowhere, it just started snowing. Oh, my God. My cat almost knocked down a glass of water next to my laptop. Jesus.
Oh, gosh.
This is a bad start.
Are you a first-time cat owner? It's a terrible combination. Water, computer.
I pushed her off the desk like four times in a row already.
Oh, call animal services.
Well, I picked her up and placed her on the floor.
Oh, so you're into hyperbole now, Chris.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just trying to paint a picture for the audience.
Okay. Today on the show, we are going to get into the latest MLB proposal. It seems like we're kind of getting closer to negotiations happening. I know that they are meeting today. The MLB is on a conference call with owners.
They approved the plan just now, actually. John Heyman just reported, as you said, that they've approved the plan to take to the Players Association.
Frank was on the conference call.
There you go. So the next step is the MLB players and the MLB just in general, right? Is that what you're saying, Chris?
It's in the players. I mean, I don't want to say it's in the players' court because there's no guarantee that the owner's proposal is fair for the players. But now the proposal will be taken to the players' union for negotiations and voting. So hopefully we get some movement. I'm less optimistic now than I was a week ago.
All right, so we'll get into that proposal. I want to get into the Javier Baez conundrum. Everyone on this podcast hates Javier Baez except for me, it seems like. I have some StatCast stats that are just random things that I found and came across. I want to find out whether or not those things matter. And in your emails, fantasybaseball@cbsi.com, a little bit later on in the show. But this latest proposal that we heard is regular season beginning in early July, anywhere from 78 to 82 games. So that's less than what we've heard before. We've heard, you know, in the 100 range, maybe even a little bit more than that. Now it's around 80. So basically half a normal season that we're used to. An expanded roster of 45 to 50 players, a universal DH in the National League. Teams would face opponents from their division and same geographic division in the opposite league. So the NL East would face the teams within their division inside the National League East, and then also the American League East, and that's to, you know, keep teams within proximity in their geographic location.
The Marlins are just going to get
pummeled
all year.
Yeah. Well, but what about the Orioles?
Oh, the Orioles. Oh,
the Orioles. Right, like, why are you picking on the Marlins? The Orioles were worse last
year. Yeah, the Orioles are worse. Yeah.
And they're worse now.
Yeah. Imagine watching all those Orioles-Marlins games this year. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Scott, we haven't heard from Scotty Dubs yet today. Scott, how's it going? How was your weekend? And what do you think of this latest proposal?
My weekend was unimportant. As for this proposal, well, it'd be interesting to see if anything that was in Ken Rosenthal's report from this weekend has changed with this owner agreement that has been approved to present to the players. But, you know, since it's happening in real time, we can't say that. But I think the biggest takeaways for me are that it's now, you know, we were thinking in terms of maybe an 100-game season, and now they're saying more like 80, which would mean probably they don't have to lean so heavily on doubleheaders and maybe don't go in as deep into October. You know, some of those ideas that had been floated out there in the past may not come to fruition if that's the case. The 45 to 50 man rosters threw me, though. I reread it a couple times, and it's not clear if Ken Rosenthal meant 40-man rosters would expand to 45 or 50 as opposed to the 26-man active rosters expanding to that many. That would make more sense, because if owners are worried about how much this is going to cost them, they're not going to want to pay 45 to 50 players like major leaguers, I presume. So, you know, we still got to find out exactly if that's what he meant, but that's my assumption right now. And, you know, it's looking more and more like if this season ever does get off the ground, that spring training, the scenario where every team's playing in their spring training parks, that's not going to be the way it happens. Ken Rosenthal did talk that, you know, maybe like Toronto, maybe like the New York teams, there may be a couple teams that do have to play in their spring training venues, at least to start out, but that's not going to be the league-wide plan. So I can breathe a sigh of relief in terms of not having to redo all of my rankings for the scenario
both
where
us,
everybody's
Scott.
Playing in the Cactus League. Yeah, that would be bad.
Yeah, we don't have to move Matt Chapman ahead of Nolan Arenado for now. What Chris mentioned was, you know, just because the MLB has the approval to bring this proposal to the Players Association, it doesn't mean that anything is happening yet. So I don't want to, you know, jump the gun and get too excited here. Ken Rosenthal also reporting right now, MLB owners have approved a proposal for a 2020 season to present to the players' union. Sources tell The Athletic, a meeting expected between union and the league tomorrow. Jeff Passan also adds, now is when it starts to get serious, and we'll know soon enough if baseball is coming back in 2020. Email of the day. I want to kind of tie this in together because we got an email from Tyler Fiddler who asked about this latest proposal. And he said, wondering your thoughts on the latest report from Ken Rosenthal about the 78 to 82 game season. How does this change your draft strategy in a head-to-head league, which I'm sure many people are wondering? Do pitchers or hitters become more valuable, or will you just stick with your usual draft strategy? Do you target more proven safe players versus trying to gamble on someone's upside? Also, with the shortened season, do you think leagues should add one or two more bench spots to accommodate the condensed season? Adam, regarding, you know, this email, will an 80-game season change how you your draft strategy in a head-to-head points league?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I still am wrapping my head around this. The biggest difference, I think, is you know, you're going to have a very short regular season. We have to figure out the best way to set up a league. I feel like Roto is kind of the way to go in a lot of instances, or maybe reduce the amount of teams that make the playoffs. I don't know. But I don't want like a really short regular season and then an extended postseason, right, in our fantasy leagues. This is really, really short. So maybe, you know, I would say ordinarily you wouldn't take like injured players, but that's not going to be even a factor here. There aren't going to be any injured players.
Well, there will be some new injuries that happen
in spring training.
Yeah, in the three-week spring training period. And, you know, whatever kind of injury one of those players suffers, it's going to be a bigger percentage
Huge.
Of the season that they miss. So you're going to downgrade them even more.
That's obvious, though. So I would say no. I would say no. This isn't going to change my strategy as of now.
Chris, the one thing I would add about if you play in head-to-head points leagues and maybe even head-to-head categories league, any league that has a head-to-head aspect, is that you can run double headers so that the season being condensed doesn't mean that, okay, you know, we're going to, instead of however many weeks a season normally is in a head-to-head league, I believe it's, what, it's 26. Like over 20?
25.
25. Yeah. So instead of having like a 12 or 13 week season for a head-to-head league, if you run double headers where you're facing two different opponents at once, you still kind of have that 25, 26 game record.
This is going to make fantasy baseball traditionalists mad, but I'm totally fine with a shorter schedule. I'm fine with the implications of a shorter schedule, meaning that there's more randomness and more chaos across the league. I think that all makes for a better and more entertaining league. Every week matters a lot more. You can actually move up and down the rankings very quickly because there's not enough time for the really good teams to separate.
Okay, but so, we've got 13 weeks, basically. So how are you even going to do that? Like how many regular season weeks do you want to have? Because we like to have two-week playoff rounds.
Yeah, I mean, two-week playoffs, that's a non-starter.
Can't happen. But what, are you going to have a 10? You're going to have a 9-week regular season?
It's too short. That's why I think you should play double headers.
But even if you play double headers, I mean, you don't have that much time for your team to improve. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to make trades that are going to impact your team as much. I don't know. Just like you might be playing double headers, which means you have 18 matchups, but that doesn't change the fact that it's a 9-week regular season. Well, actually, there's really no reason at this point to be like, oh, we're not going to play the last week of the season. Like, you're going to, right? You're going to play 13. So 10-week regular season?
Well, Here's the other thing you could consider. If you shrink the number of teams that are going to the playoffs for your league, let's say it's normally 6, but instead you make it 4, that'll buy you some extra weeks. But maybe the better way to go about it is to make the regular season, is to actually make all but the 4 worst teams, put them all in the playoffs and have more of a tournament. I don't know. That's worth thinking through. But it might make sense to kind of embrace the randomness in that regard.
Yeah, I think you could even do, there actually, this kind of creates all kinds of opportunities to try something new. Scott, which, is it the Carolina League that has 2 champions? Which minor league does that? There's one of them that has
I don't know, a first half champion
and a second half champion, or at least they used to. Maybe they don't anymore.
I could try looking it up.
There was a minor league or maybe a whole level that had first half champion, second half champion. You could do something like that. You could do the team that wins the first 5 weeks and then the team that wins the next 5 weeks, or 6 versus 6, plays each other in week 13, something like that. Like, I think there's a lot of ways that you can do this that create a lot more fun, create a lot of interest, and can keep the entire league interested through the end. I think it's an opportunity to...
Well, all right, what would you do? You're the commish. Give me your
idea. I kind of like the idea I just came up with. Highest scoring team in the first half goes against the highest scoring team in the second half, or the 2 highest scoring teams in both go into a 4-team playoff at the end. Because I like that, because it gives you the opportunity. If you're a low scoring team in the first half, you've still got a chance to make a run in the second half. There's going to be so many more players this year. Like, this year is going to be so weird for fantasy because there's going to be these expanded rosters and doubleheaders and all these, like, I think every top prospect who's at least made it to double A is probably going to be on an opening day roster at this point. If you're not going to have minor league games and you're going to have these giant rosters. I don't know.
Do you really think the rosters are going to be as big as 45?
No,
50?
I was just rereading, Scott. I think you're right. I think it's like the 40-man roster gets expanded, but sure. I think the 25-man roster is probably going to be like 30 people. But they'll have a taxi squad.
I just feel like the financial downside of activating that many prospects who may not even be ready is too great for a shortened season for teams to be willing to do that.
I would be surprised if the active roster is only 30. It was 30. It was only 30 in 1995.
I think 30 with the ability to really maneuver it a lot more. But on each particular night, you're not going to have more than 30 people active.
Like,
oh, sure. But right? That's functionally the same thing.
Well,
because guys aren't going to get used in every game.
And if they're playing fewer games in the same amount of time than we were thinking, then they're not, you know, that concern about... players having to bounce back quickly enough? Like how much of that roster are they actually going to make use of?
Yeah, that's the part that confuses me. The idea of only doing 81 games from July 1st on, because typically we'd see, you know, probably
that,
more
that
than
would
that.
Be about the same. Yeah, that's about half a season's time.
Yeah,
July 1st
so
on.
It's kind of, I'm kind of confused by this proposal, but I think you should, I think either way, given how weird it's going to be, I think trying some new things out, that's what I would do. I would do top 2 point scorers in the first half of the season, top 2 point scorers in the second half of the season, go into a 4-team playoff at the end. That sounds like a lot of fun to me.
So you're eliminating the head-to-head aspect during the regular season altogether and just saving that for the playoffs. You're just doing strict points accumulation.
I mean, you could do it either way. You could do the team with the best record and the team with the most points.
Yeah, you could do 1-1. One best record, first half, and then one highest
most
scoring points.
Most points first half, most points second half, two best records beyond them at the end of the season. Like, there's a lot of ways you can go. I think leaning into how weird this season is going to be, leaning into how unpredictable, leaning into how tiny the sample sizes are, I think it makes sense to try. Like, I think that gives more people an opportunity to compete in a league where everything's just going to be bizarre.
Yeah, everything's going to be weird. Like, across all different sports, across all different fantasy sports. I mean, these are unforeseen circumstances. So you see leagues like MLB presenting, you know, expanded rosters and more teams making the playoffs this season. So, I mean, it's an opportunity to try new things for fantasy as well. I mean, in a shortened season, why not? Why? If you've had an idea that you've wanted to try before.
I don't even, but why? I mean, I just feel like you could, those ideas are good, but why not do them in a full season too?
I think it's a trial run, just like the universal DH is going to be a trial run for baseball. And by the way, they should absolutely make that real forever.
If I were setting up a league, I would just do, I'm assuming 13 weeks because regular season's 26 weeks as far as I remember, so it's half of that. I would do either a 10 week league with 3 rounds of playoffs for 6 teams or 11 weeks with 2 rounds of playoffs for 4 teams. And I would do double headers, like Frank says, so you're playing two other opponents each week. That's what I would do. Totally respect and think
you're
it's
boring.
Really interesting what I am.
Boring.
Yeah,
interesting.
But the thing is, like, if you're going to the total points thing, like, what is the incentive to take a guy that gets injured in spring training? You're like, if you take a great player who gets injured in spring training, if you have a week one injury, you're screwed. Like, how are you going to score the most points?
That's why you have the second half of the season.
I should point out that this only sounds like it's going to be a problem that needs to be addressed in weekly leagues, right? If you're in a daily league, you could just run it the same way. There's going to be enough of a pool there.
You should expand your rosters, I think, in every league.
But the setup is still the same. I mean, you still have to decide if you're doing a daily league with weekly scoring. You still have to decide how you want to set
the playoffs. What is the incentive to expand a roster? I'm not getting that. In fantasy, I get it in real life. But
under the assumption that guys aren't going to play as much.
But that doesn't... I'm not sure I'm under that assumption anymore.
Yeah, if they're playing less games, they might not try to jam pack as many of them into the schedule. We might not see as many doubleheaders. We might not, you know, where they were talking about playing 100 or more games in a however long span from July through October or November, they might have needed to jam pack the schedule and you know, put in some doubleheaders there. Whereas if they're trying to play 80, they're probably trying to minimize some of that injury risk and
risk
in general.
I think pitchers aren't going to be used as much. Like, I don't think we're going to see, especially maybe your Max Scherzers are going to go 7 innings regularly, but I think especially for the first month or so of the season with a shorter spring training, with guys having to ramp up, then ramp down, then ramp back up again, I think teams are going to be very careful with their starting pitchers. I think we're going to see a lot more relievers used.
But even if that's the case, what does that mean? Why would expanded rosters help with that?
It would give you
maybe
more
adding
options
lineup
to
spots would help with that, but
it would
know.
Give you more options to choose from for your pitchers.
All right, guys, I want to move on to Javier Baez because we teased this a little bit last week, and I didn't really get to say my piece on Javier Baez, and it's something that I did want to talk about because it seems like, you know, he's getting no respect. This guy, you know, 2000.
Oh, come on, you're too young for that.
Yeah, it's true.
Name one Rodney Dangerfield movie.
Moving on to Javier Baez.
No way. You can't name one?
No, I can't.
I mean, look, most of them came out before I was born, but I still know them.
I've got nothing. I'm sorry.
This chair is creaking. It's driving me nuts.
Wow.
Did anybody else hear that?
Chris
sounds like somebody's creeping up on me.
Wow. Whose mouse is clicking is the real question.
I think it's probably the same person.
Chrissy clicks.
So honestly, Frank, just if I was going to recommend one Rod, if you consider Caddyshack a Rodney Dangerfield movie.
Oh, it absolutely is.
It's. I don't know that it's an anyone movie, but yeah, that one or Back to School is probably my second favorite.
All right, Caddyshack. Just wrote it down. Now, I knew the name of the movie. It's just, there's so many movies I haven't seen. It's conversation for another day.
Oh, young Frank.
Javier Baez, I mentioned it at the top. Top 10 player in Roto in 2018. He was the third best shortstop, and he was a top 15 hitter overall in that same season in 2018, where he hit 34 home runs, 101 runs scored, 111 RBI with 21 steals in 160 games. Last year was dinged up. He was dealing with some heel leg. He had a thumb issue last year and still managed 29 home runs, 89 runs scored, 85 RBI, and 11 steals. I just don't understand all the...
Who hates him?
I like him.
Scott has him very low in his ranks.
Like, I guess like, I'm the one who hates him.
The podcast hates Giancarlo Stanton. Javier Baez, like, Scott still has him as like a top 50 player, right?
Let me check.
Not in points. I hate Javier
Baez.
Sure,
not
in
points. Yeah, he's not.
He takes a hit in points because his plate discipline, and I'm done trying to figure out the, you know, who Javier Baez, like, will the real Javier Baez stand up? Because, I mean, his plate discipline is bad. It's always going to be bad, right?
And yeah, the real Javier Baez stands up at the plate and swings at everything.
He swings at everything. But for years, I discounted him because of that. And I said, look, eventually, you know, this is going to affect him. It hasn't affected him. I mean, from 2015 through 2019, he's had between a 273 and 290 batting average. He's been incredibly consistent in that regard. And since he's become an everyday player, Joe Maddon finally gave him that opportunity. He's been great the past two seasons.
My question with Javier Baez is, what for fantasy is he definitely great at? Like, top 10% in the fantasy player pool. I don't think, especially in Roto, it's kind of a jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none profile. He's a good power hitter, but not an elite one. He's going to give you good RBI and run numbers, but not elite numbers. He'll probably give you a decent batting average, and he's had one season, really, where he was a good steal source. Last season, he did miss some time. He played 141 games, but even if you extrapolate to 150 games, he was only the number 40 hitter in Roto, even at 150-game pace, and that's with a minimum of 400 plate appearances, so it's taking out guys like Aristides Aquino, who had a couple of good months. This is players who played pretty much every day. He was the number 40 hitter. That's good. I just think 2018 is more likely to be the outlier for his career. I don't know if he's a 20 stolen base guy ever again.
Yep.
And the raw power certainly exists for him to be a 40 homer guy. And I could conceive of an outcome where he has an outlier season where he hits 40 home runs, but between the contact issues and a slightly less than ideal batted ball profile, I think you're probably just expecting 30-ish home runs. And in today's major league environment, that's like, he's definitely not a bad player. I just think he doesn't stand out.
So if he hits 280 with 30 home runs, 100 runs, 100 RBI, and 15 steals,
that's a good player.
That's a very good player.
Yeah,
Roto.
No, that's
probably his best case scenario, though.
Well, why isn't 2018 his best case scenario? He was the number 7 hitter in fantasy in Roto, number 7 overall.
He's not.
That's pretty close to the stat line Frank just gave.
Frank, I think you undersold the runs and the RBIs. We have to get out of the 100-100 because depending on what environment you live in. But based on last year's environment, 200 runs plus RBIs is actually not special. So I think that's an area that for some reason took a big hit last year for him. And I was just looking it up. Like in 2018, the Cubs were ninth in scoring. In 2019, they were 10th in scoring. They obviously scored more runs because everyone scored more runs. But for some reason, his pace, his 160-game pace, that's how many games he played in 2018, the batting average was similar, 9 points difference. The home runs were exactly the same. The steals were lower, 21 steals to 13 steals. Lower. But the runs and RBIs dropped by like 20 or something like that. So I don't know what it was, but that is something where he probably has to be great in counting stats, not just good. But if he's going to be a real impact player, because Chris is right, he doesn't excel in anything. He would have to excel, I think, in runs plus RBIs, and he did that in 2018, and he didn't in 2019.
I don't know that he. We should expect him to be somebody who makes a big contribution in runs, period. I mean, they're talking about batting Bryant first, Rizzo second, Baez third, sure, but you're talking about a guy who had a .316 on base percentage last year, a .326 on base percentage 2 years ago, and who's going to be hitting behind him now? Not anyone great, a couple pretty good bats, but then the lower third of that lineup's pretty awful.
Shouldn't the RBIs go up though, Scott?
Maybe.
To compensate?
I mean, maybe you can pencil him in for 100+. The two biggest things that changed for Baez for me, and, you know, I think our podcast did hate him relative to the consensus last year. We all expected him to take a step back, and it wasn't as big as it could have been. It wasn't nearly as big as he could have been. I still think it's a risky profile, and I still think he has to remain an outlier in BABIP and home run to fly ball rate to be a high-end fantasy contributor, and it's just risky to bank on that happening year after year. But putting that aside, the biggest things that changed for Baez for me are the stolen bases regressed to the barely double-digit number we were used to seeing from him, and with a really bad success rate that causes me to wonder if we can even count on those double-digit steals. And then he's no longer eligible at second base, and shortstop is just so star-studded that how does Baez stand out from the group? If you see his profile as riskier than some of those others, as I do, you're not going to be too enthusiastic about taking him.
Would he gain second base eligibility, though?
No.
Yeah, he didn't
be there every day shortstop.
He didn't play there at all last year. Also, he jammed his
thumb. Something could happen.
So I just want to make two more points real quick, then I'll shut up. He jammed his thumb sliding into second base, missed time in September. That's not good if you're banking on him for steals. And if he's going to hit third, that's even worse if you're banking on him for steals. And now I'm done.
What is the difference between Marcus Semien and Javier Baez? Well, Javier Baez has done it for 2 years, so that's part of it. But what Marcus Semien did last year was basically Javier Baez, and he's going a lot cheaper. Even you look at someone like a guy who's going much later is Marcell Ozuna, who the batting average was much lower, .243, although most of the advanced stats that we typically lean on suggest he was pretty unlucky there. But he had 29 homers in 131 games with 12 steals. He was only caught stealing twice. And now he's going to be hitting in the heart of a very good lineup. So I just... Baez is a good player. He's just not a player that I make a point of reaching for necessarily.
And somebody else always does.
Unless he can be a 20 steal guy. I just think he's fallen back to the pack, and he's just very good and not great.
The last point I'll add is the other shortstops that go in this range, and Scott, you have a lot of these guys ranked ahead of him. I think there's some risk as well. I mean, you have question marks with a lot of players in this range. Gleyber Torres, is he going to do what he did against the Orioles again this year? I read the numbers, what he did last season outside of facing Baltimore, and it was very pedestrian. Xander Bogaerts loses one of the best bats in baseball from his lineup in Mookie Betts. Adalberto Mondesi coming off a very serious injury, and he has OBP concerns himself for someone that you want to steal bases. Jonathan Villar, is he going to remain with the Marlins the entire season? Is he going to play every single day? Is he going to, where is he going to play? Is he going to play center field? Is he going to play middle infield? So I do think that there's risk involved with all of the play, all the shortstops that are going in this third, fourth round range.
Yeah, I mean, VR and Mondesi, it's a whole different scenario for them. They're hypothetically elite base dealers, and stolen bases are by far the scarcest commodity in the 5x5 categories, at least among hitters. So they get elevated to a level that's frankly ridiculous, but it's just the game you have to play because that's how standard roto is set up. Stolen bases are that valuable right now, so that's why they go ahead of Baez. Rest assured, I have them behind Baez in my head-to-head points ranking, even though points league isn't theoretically Baez's best format.
Hey, I just wanted to add one thing I was wrong about. I mean, I figured I'd be right about this, but of course I was wrong. He stole 6 bases in 22 games batting third 2 years ago, so that has not mattered for him historically.
All right. I'm the high guy on Baez. It's fine. I'll take it. Much better player in Roto. I admittedly, the plate discipline is very bad for head-to-head points leagues, but he is my 6th-ranked shortstop, and Scott has him down at 13. So that's someone that we do disagree upon.
I'll move him up to 11th. I can justify moving him ahead of Carlos Correa and Bo Bichette. I was just looking at that as we started this conversation. To me, the three are very close in my eyes, but Bichette and Correa tend to go so much later that I don't think it makes sense to have them ahead of Baez. So I'll move Baez up to 11th at least.
Let's go, Scott. I've got some random StatCast stats that I want to get into and talk about whether or not they matter. We'll do that right after this quick break.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Worn by players like Michael Harris to meet the demand of elite ball players, the New Balance Fuel Cell 4040 V7 is a versatile option. The 4040 V7 is built for the athlete who needs responsiveness and ability to cut and run at their full speed. The model features a fuel cell foam underfoot and a synthetic and mesh upper to provide breathability, comfort, and a snug fit as you round the bases. The fuel cell midsole features nitrogen-infused foam specifically designed to propel athletes forward. Learn more about the 4040 at newbalance.com. All right, the first stat that I have here, CJ Krohn's 10.6% barrels per plate appearance ranked 6th best in baseball last season. The only 5 hitters who ranked ahead of him in this category: Nelson Cruz, Gary Sanchez, Mike Trout, Miguel Sano, and Aaron Judge. 55 home runs over the last 2 seasons for CJ Krohn. He had 25 last year in just 125 games. That's a 32 home run pace over 162 games. Scott, does this stat matter?
Does it matter? No.
If you have to think about it for that long, then it probably doesn't.
Well, it's not what I noticed before, so I was having to come to grips with it on the spot. Was it unusual for CJ Krohn to do that?
No, he was in the top 10% in the league in 2018, and that was 12.2% barrel rate. I think this is per plate appearance. Yeah, I'm not sure why the numbers are different from the one you have. But yeah, he's been consistently above average at this over the last 3 seasons and was very good in 2018 as well.
Last year, he had a 469 slug and a 548 expected slug. That 548 expected slug was in the 91st percentile. His 21% strikeout rate was also the lowest it's been since 2016. So I think in a roto league as your corner infielder makes sense. But Adam, you seem disinterested.
I just think
it
stinks that Krohn's on the Tigers now. It's a bad, it's a bad ballpark. It's a terrible lineup.
Yeah.
And I imagine that CJ Krohn is probably going to give you a 3-week stretch where he's the man, and he's probably going to be pretty useless for a big. Like, he's streaky, you know. I mean, he is what he is, I think, at this point.
Yeah. and just a moderate home run total is all you're really getting from
him. Yeah, right. Not getting much else.
Yeah.
All right, number two, Vlad Guerrero Jr. had the hardest hit ball in 2019 at 118.9 miles per hour off the bat. Even with that, his 34% hard contact rate was well below league average. League average was 38%. His splits were very weird, struggled against left-handed pitching, hit 215 with a 643 OPS. He crushed them in the minors. He hit 293 with an 822 OPS against right-handed pitching. That actually kind of makes me feel better about Vladimir Guerrero Jr., that he hit well against righties his first year in the bigs and struggled against lefties, whereas, you know, he normally did perform well against them in the minor leagues. Chris, this stat about having the hardest hit ball last season, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., does this matter?
I'll do you one better. He didn't only have the hardest hit ball in Major League Baseball last season. He led Major League Baseball in batted balls over 115 miles per hour. He had eight of those. Aaron Judge was seventh. Nobody else had more than five. So, you know, the kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the word. I think heuristic is the right word, but I'll just use that one. The assumption that I've always had is exit velocity is a proxy for raw power and potential. You can hit the ball really, really hard. If you don't do it consistently, which was the issue for Vladimir Guerrero last season, then it's not really going to matter. But this is a sign of how incredibly high the potential is for him. Hit more really, really hard hit balls than anyone in baseball. That means he had a lot of really softly hit balls, which is a problem. And he talked about that, and the Blue Jays pitching coach talked about that before the season. How his biggest issue, and we've talked about this as well, was he hit the ball on the ground too much, and he hit too many weak grounders in particular. The key for him is going to be elevating the ball and finding more consistency. And what they talked about there was he was getting a little fatigued late last season and was having trouble generating power with his legs. He was kind of falling in front of the ball, getting out in front of them and producing weak contact. So the key is going to be, one, that conditioning, and we don't know. It's not something where you can just look at him and say, well, he's in better shape now, because, look, Vladimir Guerrero is always going to be a bigger guy. I don't think we're going to see a time when Vladimir Guerrero is the fittest guy on the field. But that wasn't an issue for Miguel Cabrera in his prime. He was winning batting titles and triple crowns while looking like one of the biggest guys on the field, so it's a question of whether he can get in shape for himself and find that consistency. And this is why I've been willing to invest in him at his inflated, what I think is his inflated draft cost this year, even if I won't do it in every draft. I want some of Vladimir Guerrero, because if he does figure it out, he's going to be one of the best hitters in baseball.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s ADP is currently 58.8, so it is a tad inflated.
Oh, it's way inflated. The most likely outcome this year is Vladimir Guerrero is a giant bust at that price.
Oh, he went
so late.
Well,
before he got hurt last year, he was being drafted in like the third round.
Yeah, right. He went late in the draft.
That obviously didn't turn out so well, him going that early.
Right. Like, the most likely outcome is he's probably like a low 800s OPS bat, because that's what he showed us last year.
Mm, yeah, I don't know. Why would that be the most likely outcome, though? I mean, he was a rookie, and why wouldn't he do better? I feel like he would do better.
Well, that would be better. That would be like an 820 OPS would be like a 50-point swing for him. That would be an improvement.
Oh, well,
so
I guess I misinterpreted what you said. He went super late in the draft we did last week. He went the second-to-last pick of round 7. I was pretty surprised.
That was
that.
A 10-teamer, just to point out. So that was
okay. Then not
69th
pick.
Yeah,
still a little bit later, but yeah. You're right. Not that late. My bad.
But,
might be.
Yeah, so like, there, this is where it's like the 50th percentile outcome versus the 90th percentile outcome. His 90th percentile outcome is what Juan Soto did last year, maybe with fewer steals. Like, we're talking about,
yeah, he's the man.
The most productive minor league season arguably ever in 2018 at the age of 19. So
I'm in.
clearly the upside is huge. It's peak Albert Pujols.
It's
the absolute ceiling.
It's what I call a blind faith kind of pick, just having blind faith in the pedigree because the underlying stats don't really support him taking this big leap in production in his second season. And yet, you know, based on the pedigree, it's probably coming at some point. Will it be a second season? It's impossible to say, but there's reason to have blind faith in that happening. It's just everybody's paying up as if it will. It's different. Like Devers was the ultimate blind faith pick last year. It
right.
worked out swimmingly, but he was going much later than Vladimir Guerrero is now. So it was much easier to justify, I feel like.
Where you at on him, Frank Stamps?
What's
up? Where you at on him?
I like Vlad. I'm with Chris that I want a few shares of him just in case he does take that next step. And I think, you know, the way that Scott also labeled it is, you know, that blind faith pick like Rafi Devers, just based on the prospect pedigree. So I think what he has to do most, and we heard a report of this in February that he was working to improve his launch angle. That's the biggest key for me because he's shown flashes of being able to hit the ball extremely hard, but 49% ground ball rate, 6.7 degree average launch angle, league average is 11 degrees. I mean, he has to raise that. He's got to hit more line drives. He has to hit more fly balls. That's the only way that Vlad's going to eventually reach his peak potential is by doing that. And so there's already a report about it, so hopefully he does continue to take the next step. But I do want a few shares of him here in 2020. Number three. Justin Smoak had the second biggest difference between batting average and expected batting average. He hit 208 with a 250 expected batting average. And he had the biggest difference between his slug and his expected slug. He had a 406 slugging percentage last year, a 495 expected slug. Scott, does this matter when it comes to Justin Smoak?
I think it matters. I mean, he was with the Blue Jays last year, right? And I feel I should know that. So it was a good place to hit already, but Miller Park, even better. And we've seen it turn kind of forgotten players into stars in the past, Jesus Aguilar being a very recent example. And it wasn't too many years ago. Justin Smoak himself was a must-start player in fantasy with that 33-homer season, I believe it was.
Yeah, 2018? 2017.
2017, and his expected stats, they weren't as good as they were then, but they were the best they've been otherwise. So he had, at least as far as underlying stats are concerned, his second best season, and you look at the numbers and, well, they weren't there. It could go a lot better for him this year. The biggest problem is how much is he going to get to play? The Brewers signed Avisail Garcia for a lot more money. So I suspect he's going to play more just because of that. And then you have Ryan Braun bouncing back and forth between right field and first base as needed. And, you know, he deserves playing time too, based on the way he's performed. So I'm not exactly sure how that's going to shake out. I think Smoke's going to be the loser in the end.
But the universal DH solves a lot of those problems.
That's true.
Because
whole new world.
The idea was Braun and Smoke would kind of split time at first base. With maybe Braun playing some corner outfield occasionally, just put Braun at DH every day. And all of a sudden, you've got an open first base job for Justin Smoak. You've got a corner infield spot for Avisail Garcia, and everyone can play. And that makes Justin Smoak and Avisail Garcia, I think, you know, I wrote about this a couple weeks ago when the Universal DH was first talked about. It makes it, both of them two of the biggest winners from this. Justin Smoak was one of my favorite sleeper first basemen to begin with, and this stat is a big part of it. And I really like Justin Smoak a lot as a late round sleeper. What's interesting, another interesting Statcast stat, he's been better against the shift over the last couple years than he has with no shift. So it's not even necessarily that the defense is hurting him. He is one of the slowest people in professional baseball and maybe all professional sports, but so that will knock down your expected stats differential a little bit, but it doesn't explain all of this.
Yeah, no, that's good. Smoak does seem like a big winner of that DH universal DH scenario, and I probably need to move him up. He'd still be outside my top 20 first baseman, but I could see him being in the top 25.
And he absolutely has top 12 potential if everything goes right in that part.
I probably move him ahead of Aguilar with the with the Marlins.
Yeah, Smoke's 2017, where he hit 270, 38 home runs, 90 RBI, was really his standout season. Yeah. It's been downhill since then. He was the 10th best first baseman in Roto that year. He was the 11th best first baseman in points leagues. Something to consider in points leagues, he walks a ton. I mean, his plate discipline is not an issue. And last year, 42% hard contact, 42% fly ball rate. So he does hit the ball hard. He puts the ball in the air. I know something we spoke about recently was, why aren't switch hitters more prevalent in the game anymore? The past two seasons, he cannot hit left-handed pitching.
Oh, totally. And Jed Jerko can. And that's a guy that could take at-bats from him against lefties. Sure. It's interesting.
Or even Braun again.
And really, I want to... Well, yeah, I would say Braun for sure, but you know, the universal DH does sort of solve that problem. So you have to go a little bit deeper. But I'm trying to figure out how I feel about this scheduling thing. Because on one hand, I feel like the players that are in great ballparks win. Because if you play half your games in a great ballpark over a shorter period of time, like a much shorter period of time, I think that's an advantage, I think.
No, because the rate is still the same.
Yeah, but like it is, but I'm also trying to wrap my head around like the other parks that they're playing. Like, I don't know.
Right. I think the bigger thing is we're going to have to keep in mind that the Brewers will be playing under this proposal half their games at Miller Park and then all of their games in the rest of the AL and NL
Central.
And
the AL Central has bad parks, but they also have bad pitchers.
Yeah. It's hard to find. Like, I think the NL East teams are the clear winners from that proposal because they get to take Fenway, Yankee Stadium, Rogers Center, and Camden in as part of their park. So I think they're the winners. But
and the AL West gets to be in Coors Field, and the NL West probably has even like a bigger share of Coors Field. Then we'll see how it is. But I would imagine. Yeah. Nobody else getting Coors Field outside of those two divisions, and the NL West will have a higher share of Coors Field games than normal, except for the Rockies, who stay at 50%. But I'm trying to, I don't know. I've got a lot of wheels stirring up here. They're kind of going backwards, but they're sort of.
I see throughout the show, Adam is just like staring off into the distance, the trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, the train of thought is still boring.
The fourth stat that I had here is actually regarding Justin Smoke's former teammate, Danny Jansen, who had the third biggest difference between his batting average and expected batting average, and had the sixth biggest difference between his slug and expected slug. So 207 batting average, 247 expected, 360 slug, 418 expected. Does hit a good amount of fly balls, makes harder contact than the league average. And he was crushing it in the spring, too. 20 spring training plate appearances. He was hitting .529 with 4 homers and 13 ribbies. So, for all you Roto players out there, second catcher, Danny Jansen. I think it matters.
I've drafted him as my number one catcher if I waited in a points league. He was awful for the first month. And we've talked about him quite a bit as a sleeper. But he was awful for the first month plus of the season. I think it was like the first 35 games. For him, he had not hit a home run. He had an OPS right around 500. And then so it was May 17th, his first 31 games. He hadn't hit a home run, and he had a 447 OPS. He homered on two games in a row. And then from that point on, he had an 800 OPS or something like that. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to like about Danny Jansen as a sleeper. And if I'm waiting at catcher in a one catcher league, I'm fine with him being my option.
Yeah, I am too. I don't even know that I put that much stock in the expected stats for him. I mean, part of it is just his numbers. His raw numbers were so bad as to the point of being unbelievable. I mean, the expected stats still aren't good. It's more about, I think he's just changed his approach so significantly that he might be a completely different hitter when we see him again. At least that's the way the narrative was shaping up, and that's the way the production was shaping up in that tiny, 3 weeks of spring training that we saw players play. You know, understanding, of course, that we expected him to be good heading into last year, too, so we know the talent is there, and that big of an overhaul could be what allows him to tap into it.
Yeah, before we get into some questions, and I had a few other ones that I wanted to get to, maybe I'll put these together in an article. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, go for it. I think there's still some really interesting ones left to talk about.
All right. See what I could do. See what I can make happen here. I just want to remind everyone, fantasy football fans specifically, remember when you won your league with LaDainian Tomlinson in 2006 or Randy Moss in 2007? Or were you the one who bought into Peyton Hillis after his big season? Well, this entire week, the Fantasy Football Today podcast is becoming Fantasy Football Yesterday. They're looking back at the best and worst seasons of the last 20-plus years in fantasy football, the Mount Rushmores at each position, the biggest breakouts and busts, and all the best memories from fantasy football since the late 90s. Relive it this week for 5 episodes with Fantasy Football Yesterday on the Fantasy Football Today podcast. Available wherever you find this podcast, Fantasy Baseball Today podcast. Adam, did I miss anything?
No, you just missed the part where like my criteria for drafting the best fantasy seasons was so much better and more sophisticated than everybody else's, which is why
why you had one of the worst teams.
Yeah, this is why I had the worst team, because I was just drafting with something that people just can't understand. They just can't, like, it was just too advanced. You know, you just go too advanced and people didn't get it. No, I tried to draft not just on whoever scored the most fantasy points, but the players that dominated at their position the most, the players that outperformed their average draft position the most. And everybody's just like, "Oh, give me fantasy points." I'm like, all right, that's hard. Whatever.
Yeah, it's fun. We're doing some nostalgia on FFT all week. We're on HQ every day at noon. We've got tons of articles as well, so it's fun times.
Go check it out. Fun times. This question comes from Luke in Anderson Island, Washington. Hey, Mike, Larry, Manny, and Pete. Anything?
1997 MVPs and Cy Youngs? Does that make any sense?
Maybe, but what I have is Mike Schmidt, Larry Boa, Manny Trio, and Pete Rose.
Were they Philadelphia Phillies champions?
Yeah.
No, they were not the champions. Phillies. I don't think.
They were Phillies at some point. I don't know when. With the discussion of playing with expanded rosters, how would you handle the number of lineup positions in Dynasty Leagues? Would you also expand rosters for the shortened season with the idea of, quote, going back to normal when there's, God willing, a normal season in 2021? What do you think, Scott?
That's fine.
Well, yeah, we kind of talked about this a little earlier. I'm not sure. I still not sure I get why that would be necessary. So it gives you more options, but why? I mean, you'll always like more options, right? Like, what makes it necessary to have more options this year? I guess I'm asking Chris, because we were the ones going back and forth earlier.
You're the guy who says that fantasy baseball should reflect real baseball as much as possible, Scott. I'll flip it back to you. Why shouldn't fantasy baseball reflect real baseball this year, Scott? Why aren't you being consistent? What doesn't Scott want the people of America to know?
Well, I mean, obviously the way you're setting a lineup and the moves you can make to account for injuries are far different than what they are in real life. You can just add and drop a player if you lose a player to injury. You don't have to, you know, go to somebody on your bench or whatever. I don't see why it'd be any different. I don't see the need for it. And when you're talking a dynasty scenario specifically, that gets really sticky with the way you handle keepers once the season's over, if you're planning on going back and shrinking the rosters. I just don't see it. It just seems more like an exploitive thing. Like, I've always wanted to have extra players, and now this is a way I can get away with it if I run.
Well, yeah, but
league.
that's what MLB's doing. They've always wanted a universal DH.
No, I'm saying it's different. It's different.
But no, that's what I'm saying is MLB is using the condensed schedule and all this to backdoor the universal DH.
But I understand why the need for the universal DH. If you're going to have that much league crossover, you don't want you want the AL teams to be able to use their DH spot. So
I actually do agree that you shouldn't change midstream in a dynasty league. Like, if you want to include an extra roster spot or an extra lineup spot at pitcher and hitter just to kind of account for the possibility of more players playing and everyone kind of having lower counting stats, that's fine. But I don't think you should make dramatic changes to this for one season in a dynasty league in particular.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well.
Mike, Larry, and Pete were on the 1980 Phillies. Who did you say Manny was?
Manny Trio?
Well, that team won the World Series. So you might have been right, Chris.
There you go.
After being incredibly wrong about my first guess.
Manny Trio.
This next one's from Luke, is from the D. I have DJ LeMahieu and Javier Baez as my middle infield. Shout out to Lucas. Let's go. Javier Baez. My commish keeps trying to get me to trade him for Francisco Lindor. I think I would be giving up too much. I have Jonathan Villar and Castro on the bench. I assume that's Starlin Castro. Do I trade up or stick with my roster? So it's a 10-team head-to-head league. If the question is, would you trade LeMahieu and Javier Baez for Lindor?
Yes.
I would try to do Baez and VR if you can make that happen.
Either way, I'd do it.
Yeah.
Especially in a 10-team league.
I think Baez and VR, he just says head-to-head. He doesn't say whether it's points or categories, because right. In categories, giving up VR might be difficult to replace those steals. But yeah, I mean, this is particularly in a shallow league like this. This is why two-for-one trades are so reviled, because you consistently make trades like that in a shallow league where you can just backfill off the waiver wire. You're going to put your team in a really good spot. And so people don't often agree to two-for-one trades like that. It's worth a try. Baez for VR, unless you need the steals.
That was the starting
infield. Baez and VR for Lindor, sorry.
Starting infield of the 1980 world champion Philadelphia Phillies.
Yeah.
That's a classic Frank two-for-one, if you can pull that off. So I'd support it, Lucas. Let's make it happen.
Classic
this
Frank
last one comes
one,
from
I love it.
Classic Frank two-for-one. You know, ask the people in my home league. Not too happy with me. This last one comes from Esteban from the Emerald City. Was listening to your trade etiquette pod and made me think of a controversial trade last year that the league still talks about as veto-worthy or not. 10-team keeper league. You can keep three players for 3 years at their draft slot, plus one the following year. Free agent pickups during the season are allowed to be kept as your last pick the following year. The trade was involving a team that was pretty much out of it and thinking about the next season, and a top three team at our trade deadline. I, the top three team, had Ronald Acuna and Juan Soto as my two keepers for the next year, which would be this season, 2020. And he goes on, but basically, he had too many players he could keep, so he decided to shop Fernando Tatis, who was also a keeper. He picked him up before the season started, so it would be a last-round pick. And he wound up trading Fernando Tatis Jr. and Mike Soroka for Francisco Lindor, Matt Chapman, and Jack Flaherty. What do you guys think of the trade? Does it just come down to how each manager values keepers?
That's fine.
Was it unfair?
It's totally fine.
Yeah,
like that's
good trade.
This is what a keeper league is like. You have two teams with two competing goals. Both of them were able to achieve their goals in this trade. There's no issue with this.
Yeah, I'm assuming Tatis and Soroka were really cheap keepers, and Lindor, Chapman, and probably Flaherty were relatively expensive. Is that what we're?
That's my assumption.
Yeah, these trades happen in my home keeper league all the time. Yeah. I looked this up before the show, and Vlad Guerrero Jr. was a 17th round keeper in my home league, and he was traded for Charlie Blackmon, Clayton Kershaw, and Marcus Stroman last year. And sometimes there's, you know, there is some controversy over it, because it's these fire sales happen every year. I'm trying to figure out a way that we can kind of limit them, because something like this just seems a little egregious. But overall, I mean,
just imagine the Milwaukee Brewers complaining that the Chicago Cubs traded a prospect for Aroldis Chapman during a playoff race. Like that would be ridiculous. This is how keeper and dynasty leagues work. One team isn't trying to win this year. They're looking for future value. The other one has future value. They give up for current day value. There's absolutely nothing offensive about this trade. even a little bit.
Should you limit how many players you can get back in a keeper trade, Chris?
No.
Like, I can only get two of your best players in return for my Fernando Tatis, who's a great keeper.
No, the only thing, the only rule I have in one of my leagues where I'm commissioner is, if you, and this is really just off season, if you make a trade in the off season, you have to keep the players involved, all of them. But beyond that, I have no, like, things, whatever the player, it's better to get something than nothing, right? For a player you're not going to keep.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you can look at that from a real life perspective too, right? Like, that's why if a team knows they're not going to re-sign somebody, then yeah, try and trade them at the deadline to get some kind of prospect or young player. So I guess it makes sense. Just, I've seen some crazy stuff go down in some of the leagues that I play in. But that'll do it. We're done here today, boys. Happy Monday to everyone out there. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again on Tuesday. Bye-bye.